Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Wedgehead Pinball Podcast. My name is Alan. I am one half owner of the Portland Pinball Bar Wedgehead and your host of the Wedgehead Pinball Podcast. I am joined by my co-host, who's not affiliated with the Bar Wedgehead in any way, but he's one half.
Yeah, proud patron and one half of this podcast. I'm Alex. Alan likes to call me the water boy.
He worked in water. If anyone's wondering why he has that nickname, he works in water.
But more importantly than us today is our guest, the esteemed, the one and only Ty Palmer.
Oh, thanks for having me. I want to do my fractions too. I am one quarter of the bartending staff at Wedgehead. I'm one quarter of Boy Ride.
Yes. Boy Ride, the illustrious Boy Ride. Yeah.
It's a secret society.
It's an adventure team. And I'm also one half of the previous Cobros podcast. And I am one whole Ty Palmer.
Yeah, if you've been keeping up, it adds up to 1-to-1.
It does.
We checked the math beforehand.
Yep, two quarters, one half, one whole.
So today we're going to be talking about Bally Games, solid state manufacturer, and specifically the era from, is this 1979 to 1981, kind of curtained by the Susan B. Anthony coin. Ty, what is a Susan B. Anthony coin?
It was a dollar coin that was minted between 1979 to 1981, like you said, and they produced about 1 billion of these coins. They minted a lot of them, and it was meant to kind of take the place of a dollar bill or be more of like an international standard for currency, kind of like more of a European or Canadian thing where they have loonies and toonies for $1, $2, you know, thing. Yeah, it was supposed to be a big thing with coin op, not just, you know, pinball, but vending all over the place.
Yeah, that makes sense. I didn't really think about how big, like, yeah, I guess that's why you would do coins, right? And that's probably why other countries kind of held on to them.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm always surprised. But Americans didn't like them, and they killed it quick.
Yeah, killed it real quick. So it just lives in this small little brief period where, like, Bally machines were insanely good.
Mm-hmm.
And, you'd pop one into a Bally machine or any other pinball machine from that era, and you'd get 5 plays for $1.
Right, like what you'd see now when you put $2 into a Stern instead of 1 or whatever, and they give you 3 plays. It was kind of their way to incentivize you to try to play games with your friends or just play more games in general.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Give you a volume discount for putting a full dollar in.
Yeah, Bally leaned into it hard, though.
They put it right in the middle. So usually in the 2 coin slots on the coin door, the Susan B. Anthony or the SBA, you'll see it labeled, would be right in the middle of the 2.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of trippy how they'd have it advertised. They'd have a sticker on top of the coin door with, like, the image of the coin next to the branding and, like, this arrow design surrounding the coin. And then a playfield topper, like you said, Alex. Yeah, I just like, why were they so invested in it?
It's funny that they're just promoting it. It's like they really wanted to get those coins hyped up. And so it's kind of just this funny little era of, I don't know, them trying to sell us on these coins, I guess. But really, it just happens to coincide with some of the best Bally pinball machines of all time, which is really what we're here to talk about.
Yeah, we got some bangers on the list. And we could just start with the year 1979.
Yeah, so the first on the list of the SBA games from Bally would have been Star Trek, designed by, what is that, who did that?
Gary Gayton.
Gary Gayton. That's not a name I remember very often, and that's not a game that I think about very often, despite them making 16,000 of them.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. I don't play it as much as I play other solid states from that era, but, you know, it has some quirks to it and plays pretty well. You know, the art's okay.
The art's hilarious to me because they've got, like, the super buff Captain Kirk.
Yeah.
Like, they just, like, really went all in.
I wonder if Shatner wanted that. Like, I wonder if he's like, make me buff, dude.
Well, the game we're going to talk about immediately after this, that's definitely the case on.
Oh, yeah.
With Star Trek, I just think that's funny because it's, like, the first time I saw that, I don't know anything about Star Trek. Our friend, shout out to Johnny Demonic here in Portland. He's a big Trekkie, and he'd probably die if I said this, but I had no idea the game was from a different era than the TV show. The TV show was already old as hell when this game came out. It was already like a, whatever, 15-year-old show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of funny. It's like the art is intentionally retro. The colors are kind of retro. But now the game itself is so much older than the show was when it released. So it has this very weird old school vibe. It's kind of a timeless looking machine to me. It's not my favorite, but it is cool.
Yeah.
It's a good start, you know, good start of the run.
It looks like they sold almost 17,000 units on this game.
Yeah, it's a nutty amount.
Yeah.
I mean, that's massive. That already puts it in one of the highest selling games of all time list, which we're going to see a lot here. It looks like Bally, at this point in time, had caught all the way up. They were the first people to adopt solid state into pinball, and they hit the ground running. I think Stern Electronics, who we'll talk about in a different episode, when we talk about solid state games, they basically copied the Bally board system for this first,
yeah,
and, you know, kind of a slap on the wrist. They were in some hot water with Bally and they came to some sort of gentlemanly agreement.
I know other people have dived into that more, and it was kind of just like a gentleman's thing. I think they like let them use some mechs they had developed or something. It was just back in the day, I don't think they necessarily saw it as so much competition as just, you know.
They definitely saw it as competition. It's just there was more of, I heard an interview, and hopefully we'll get him on the show soon, with Roger Sharp, where he was talking about being in an office with one of the pinball manufacturers, and the phone rings as Roger's there to interview him, and the guy picks up the phone, and he's like, oh, yeah, what do you need? Oh, okay, yeah, well, I can get you a box of those or whatever, and he hangs up the phone, and Roger's like, who is that? And he was like, oh, that was Dave Gottlieb over at Gottlieb, or it was, you know, whoever, over at Genco, or it was, you know, at Williams. And he's just like, oh, so you guys just sort of, he's like, yeah. I mean, it's like, it was more like fraternal then.
Yeah.
There was definitely competition. They were definitely trying to outsell each other. It's not like it was all kumbaya. They collaborated more, and they definitely, you'll see this with pinball, why there's so many mechanisms in pinball, from like pop bumpers to spinners to drop targets to these things that are like, all could be their own patents.
Mm-hmm.
And like enforce, like they could enforce them and be like, hey, you can't do a target that drops down. You can't do this or whatever. But instead, they just sort of like, yeah, that's just part of pinball. We're going to take some of your stuff and you're going to take some of our stuff. And then we'll just kind of, you know,
yeah,
look the other way. And then you won't sue us and we won't sue you type of thing.
Right.
Yeah. It's good to see them play nice when they're like the titans of industry and like not really looking at each other like they're like death, you know, rivals.
Very different than I feel like you would expect. I don't know how the industry all is now, I guess, pinball, but that's definitely not how most businesses run.
Not at all.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine.
So how do you follow up a Monster Seller licensed theme like Star Trek?
You put in a monster themed men in a rock and roll band called Kiss.
Yeah, and this is the original Kiss game.
The first, yeah.
1979. They did sell a full 17,000 units. Designed by the legendary Jim Patla, who we'll mention again on this list, as well as probably in the future on his own episode.
Yeah, one of the rare machines that actually have a symmetrical playfield, both left and right, have same shots, same areas drops, same area targets. And
Jim Patla did that a lot. I'm going to ask him about that if we can ever talk to him on this show. But he did that quite a bit.
He liked the symmetrical stuff.
He did.
Yeah.
And even his games, because like we're going to get down the list into like biking and something that's not symmetrical, but at first glance, it kind of is. It's like the shots do different stuff, but they're in the same place. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
He did do that.
Totally.
From there, get into something real good.
Yeah, yeah.
Aragon.
First wide body.
First wide body on this list. Not first wide body of any pinball, but first Susan B. Anthony wide body.
Yeah, I thought it was the first wide body that Bally did.
That makes sense. I think Atari was the one doing wide bodies first, and everybody scrambled because they thought wide bodies were going to take over the whole thing.
That's interesting.
They didn't. But I'm pretty sure Atari was the first to do wide bodies.
This one sold over 9,000 units, designed by Greg Kamek. And this is a super wide body. I mean, we're talking about wide bodies, but this is like
mega wide.
Oh, yeah. The Bally wide bodies are real big.
It's a Cadillac. Yeah. There's a lot to do.
Paragon's so sick. It's disappointing that it sold like half as many as Kiss or something, but it doesn't have the theme and it was probably more expensive. I don't know. That's my guess.
Yeah,
but
I wonder.
That game's cool, man.
Paragon's the best of the ones we've discussed so far.
Yeah.
By a wide margin. The art package by Paul Ferris is unbelievable. Like, legendary. This is firmly in what I also would call, we're calling this the Susan B. Anthony era where we're talking about these games, but this is the artistic style, which is the Bally nipple era, where you're seeing, like, erect nipples under very skimpy clothing.
Yeah, everyone jokes. It must have just been cold as hell in the 70s, man.
It's cold in Chicago. You ever been there?
Yeah.
Like,
you ever wear a t-shirt in the winter in Chicago?
Yeah.
But also, too, yeah, swords and tits.
Yeah.
It's just the era of swords and tits.
Yeah, they knew what the kids wanted in the arcades.
Hey.
I guess not as much as they wanted muscly men and Kiss, though, because it sold half.
Well, Kiss was a huge band, though.
Kiss was just as naked.
They were a current massive band at that time.
Yeah.
They're still, to be fair to Kiss, they're still a monster license.
Yeah.
Oh,
like, they can still sell, and this is, like, 40 years later. So, I suppose.
But Paragon's a fucking kick-ass game.
It is.
Paragon rules.
We have Ty on the show, because Ty is sort of our solid-state guru.
Mm-hmm.
This is all Ty plays, or games from like a 4-year period in the late 70s, early 80s.
Don't touch anything else. Everything else is kind of a waste of time or money, and it's just simple economics. If I see a Jersey Jack, I'm walking the other way. If you give me the option, I'm not going to. It's just why.
So this is why we wanted Ty on the podcast, because we love solid state games. We talk about it on the podcast, but Ty is on a different level. Like that is, he doesn't just love solid state games. It's like that's pretty much all he wants to play.
Yeah.
There's kind of a reason, and it's a shame that we don't get modern games like this, and we're kind of starting to see some push for that. TNA, I think, was kind of a little taste of that,
sure.
Even though it doesn't really have the solid state flavor.
Beatles got there a little bit, then the Bond limited edition gets there. Yep. I played
and
that,
now,
you know.
Pulp Fiction coming is the first one that I'm like, that, I mean, it's because they went all in. They actually committed to the bit. The whole thing, it's like, down to the coin door, you know, this, like, the SBA team at Bally would be proud.
They would be. And they even like stenciled the art on the side. Like they would spray paint the bodies of these machines instead of doing airbrush or even decal. So yeah, I feel like they got that right for Pulp Fiction.
I wonder if we can get a Susan B. Anthony coin door installed on Pulp Fiction when yours shows up, Alan.
I think it's just a little slot, you know?
We
can make
you
a sticker.
You should try to run it back. Yeah.
Yeah.
Bring in your SBAs, kids. You get 5 for $4.
Before we go on, I mean, why do you think that the Susan B. Anthony coin didn't stick in America?
I think a lot of coin operators, when it came down time to like use these things, it just wasn't as practical. People probably still stuck on the dollar. You know, like it just. The main reason.
They look like quarters.
They look like quarters. Yeah, that's a huge
reason. I think that's the real problem.
Yeah. And
they look so much like quarters.
Imagine like soldering just a little bit of weight on a quarter and making it a dollar.
Yeah.
Because that's the shithead tactics my dad did when he was playing, EMs back in the day. He would take pennies and clip them till they weigh the same as dimes. And he would just go to his local five and dime, play sky jump all day for pennies on the dime. But he got the
genius move.
Yeah, it is. So like they look the part. I mean, I even like we were playing Firepower one time at Wedgehead when you guys were open the first year, and I accidentally put a quarter in where the SBA slot was, and it was programmed for SBA, and it went through, and I got 3 plays, and I'm like, Alan, I pulled you aside. I'm like, why isn't this? This gave me more than I should have got. So imagine. You know, if something was a little bent or broken on the coin door, that you probably could just, you know, pump quarters through for SBA value.
I bet it was probably annoying to also like fish SBAs out of your quarter, like
out of your quarters, dude. From an operator, you're trying to like do your tally.
Yeah,
you're like, yeah. And it's kind of funny. I never thought about that. Trying to get, so if you've not seen, if you're listening to this and you've never seen an SBA coin, they're slightly bigger than a quarter, like very slight.
Yep.
And they're the same color and everything. So just from like a management perspective, they're confusing. But trying to just shove a quarter into the thing, how do they know? Is it based, you try to calibrate the switch?
It's usually size.
That's funny.
So it's the coin mechs are the size. They're made to, it's supposed to be an exact size, which is why you'll see with like tokens or any other coins or Canadian quarters.
Yeah.
Canadian quarters look a lot like American quarters.
Yeah.
You'll see them, but they'll usually get rejected. Or they'll just get jammed at a coin mech, right? And you go to fish them out, and then you have these Canadian quarters. It's usually calibrated to the size of a coin. So each coin mech on the inside that you don't see behind the coin door as the player is a different size. And it's only meant to take one very specific diameter size of coin.
Huh.
So I think the older ones, like Ty was talking about with his dad, was they were a little bit less sophisticated.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it's like you could trick those a little bit more easily. The new ones, hopefully, best case scenario, it just rolls right through the bottom and rejects out.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times they just fucking jam and it just pisses everybody off.
Yeah, that's like every operator's nightmare is coin jams. It's just like the one thing you're going to have to fix more than anything in pinball is fucking coin jams.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you have an arcade, you're just every day people are just going to be this game, and you just got to do it all the time.
And how players deal with coin jams. You're like, let me shove a knife in there and hit the machine several times. It makes it worse. So that'll probably like just ruin.
I slap the shit out of the doors always, which I feel like if you haven't seen clear a jam, people will be like, what are you doing?
Yeah,
but it's
like
when you've had to clear them, you kind of just, you got this motion, you know, you really just kind of jab it. And half of the time they clear, and so you're like, I know what I'm doing. I just look crazy.
Yeah, the Fonz, dude. He did it famously on Happy Days over and over again.
I've never watched that.
You never seen that?
I'm not over here watching Happy Days.
Oh, man. I'm missing out.
So following up Paragon, eventually we're going to have to start skipping games so we don't run out of time.
Oh,
but we
totally.
Got to talk about the next one or the next couple. But the next game to come out was Harlem Globetrotters, 1979 still, another big licensed game, big production number, 14,500 made, and that game's a banger.
Oh, yeah. It's basically like Paragon Jr. They took kind of all the, you know, the rights of Paragon, kind of like shrunk it down a little bit, because you have in-lane drops, you know, you have your spinner for value, go up top to collect. You have all these wonderful things that they took from Paragon and be like, you know what, how do we make this better? And they did. And I love that machine. We have it right now at Wedgehead, and I will be really bummed when Rhodes pulls it.
It's going to get pulled at some point, like all games do.
They all do. Well, good things must pass.
We're bringing a Stars in soon, so
it's going to be good.
Ooh, I'm not going to complain about that. That's fucking sick. And then from there, we get to our first George Christian game of the night,
which
is Future Spa, another wide body. Somebody else describe the theme.
Oh, yeah. So it's basically, if you like Lonnie Anderson and Bo Derek, you're fucking stoked. You have five Lonnie Andersons on the play field, all like diving around water. There's some future shit, like a guy's curling a laser bar for exercise in a pond that's flowing from a woman's hair. And there's lots of mirrors, lots of neon. Like, it's a shiny, awesome view of the future.
I would call it horny space gym.
Yeah, totally.
Like, it's just like horny future people working out.
The main centerpiece of the back glass is like a guy kind of chasing after a girl, which is just so, it's maybe not in the best taste, but it's awesome. The art is,
I don't think any of this art, this is the Bally Nipple era. Like I said, you look it up, go on IPDB and look at these photos.
It's all a product of its time.
Oh, yeah.
It is. The one thing I will say about art and design for this period is the typography for most of these games is absolutely fantastic. Like, that is polished, and that you can actually, like, look at with pride and be like, you know what? They did killer custom typography for all these back glasses. Like, you know, Xenon stands out. Apol Deluxe stands out. And they just look amazing. But, yeah, a lot of the Paul Ferris, like, tits and swords art, it can be, you know, whatever.
Well, and they all did it, like Dave Christensen all the guys that were doing art for these games. It had to come from the top.
I mean, they knew what would sell. They knew what would get. They knew what would earn. I guess
they knew what they would sell. They knew what would earn, and you see the numbers, and they did fucking earn. This is where they went from like maybe third place. I don't even know. It's hard to know, but in the early 70s, they were behind. They were behind. Gottlieb was number one by a lot. I think Williams was number two. And then Bally, this is where they jumped, I think, from number three to number one, is this era. They went the first to go to Solid State, and they started licensing games.
Yep.
Two things you still see today.
Yep.
Like, we're never going to go back to EM games, obviously, so we're still in the Solid State era, and every game's got to be licensed nowadays.
And I think a big difference with Bally at the time, too, was that they invested in art when other companies were not. Like, if you go to Stern Electronics, like we said, we'll talk about a different episode, they had some sick games. Their stuff was cool. Their art, for the most part, was pretty phoned in. Some packages were really good, but a lot of them went out the door looking like ass.
And
Bally, pretty much every game on this list had a sick art package that was well-polished. They had good people doing every piece of it. It's not like they forgot about the plastics. They would have a different person doing the plastics as their full assignment, and it was just like everything kicked ass on it, man.
Yeah, totally hand-illustrated. Beautiful art.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really well done. And like when they were screening the play fields, you know, they pushed the limit for amount of colors they could get on there and use unique color too to their advantage and use like awesome teals, amazing magentas, and made these things pop and actually had really good color theory that, you know, balanced the way these art packages looked.
Yeah. Yeah. They're gorgeous games. I think it's also cool that the colors, everything about them, they all, you know, you see a lineup of Bally's, they all kind of fit in with each other, but each one has its own vibe. And not to knock on like modern pins, but a lot of like the time when you see modern games, they kind of all blend together. You know, there are a bunch of bright greens, bright reds, bright blues or whatever. And it's like the games of this era, just they really knew how to like do a lot with the art.
Yeah. You look at newer Sterns, I feel like they use every crayon in the box and just run the full spectrum of colors. You like squint your eyes, you look at Godzilla, you're like, oh my God, it looks like the exact other game that's right next to it in newer Sternfield. Yeah,
exactly. So, yeah, after Future Spot, our boy George Christian, he got a couple more games, Dolly Parton and a Nitro Ground Shaker. I'm going to just kind of skip ahead a little bit here.
Sure.
You guys specifically wanted to talk on those. Nitro Ground Shaker is sick.
It is a fun
I
one.
Love the theme, love the art. It's not my favorite game. I don't want to do George dirty, you know, talk about it too much.
It's one of those ones that's like really, I don't know.
I think Nitro Ground Shaker is better than Dolly Parton. Dolly Parton's
I agree.
Dolly Parton's the George Christian game that I wish was so much better than it is. I love Dolly Parton. She's America's sweetheart.
It's true.
Really, truly a treasure to this country
yeah.
and to the world. And it's rad that she has a pinball machine. I wouldn't have picked any other designer other than George to do it.
It's not his best.
And the layout's not bad. It's the rule set. It's just not great.
It's also, we'd compare it to some of our absolute favorite games of all time, some of which we'll get into still down here.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, I was just like, let's just save the George Christian talk maybe for...
I'll still play it whenever I see it, because it's Dolly.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful game.
Both of these are still fun. Unlike... the next game on
Silver
the list.
Silver Ball Mania. Oh, my God.
I've had fun playing it. It's got an insane art package. They sold over 10,000 of them, which is the most on this list so far. That wasn't a licensed theme. And it's
sold more than Paragon.
Absolutely batshit crazy art package.
Yeah, and you mean that in the most literal way. Like, it's insane. You have...
It's pinball themed.
Yeah.
As all good pinball machines are themed,
yeah.
The theme is pinball.
Just pull it up on your phone and look at the back glass.
It's got like chrome dudes. It's very like this late 70s psychedelic era. Very cool use of colors in that one specifically, because it's really kind of like blues and chromes and silver, and it's insane. But game, not the best from Jim Patlin.
No.
And the next one that follows this up is Space Invaders. Another very, very cool looking game, kind of one note gameplay, another Jim Patlin, symmetrical play field. It's actually, now that I say this, that's kind of like the wide body, because it has a U-turn right in the middle.
It does.
There's some similarities coming right off of Silver Ball Mania. We've seen a couple of those already.
Yeah, this one has more of an interesting story than it does have gameplay, you know, because there is a lawsuit involved with this.
Interesting.
Yeah, they got sued by 20th Century Fox because they ripped off the Xenomorphs from Alien. And like all of like H.R. Giger's designs are like used for the back glass. The playfield actually mimics more Space Invaders than the back glass. But the back glass looks really cool and has that mirrored effect where it has like that kind of infinity mirror, but a big xenomorph in the middle of it looking at you head on. And they did not license that. They're just like, this movie rules. This, what does that have to do with Space Invaders? Like, there's so much shit in space. Yeah. Like, aliens. You're like the movie Aliens. You're like, yeah, dude, let's fucking rip this shit off. And they got sued.
It's funny because it's like you'd think having the license or name of Space Invaders, which is like a very iconic, popular arcade game, especially in the era, you'd think that would be enough. And they're like, no, man. They're like, we got to take some art from a cool movie, too.
Yeah.
I think that the art package sold this game, though.
100%.
Also, though, it's probably this, again, another Jim Patlin game that sold over 10,000, this 11,400 units. Jim's just moving units, dude. So I bet at this point, if you're an operator and you have some of his previous games, you're like, cool.
Sign me up.
Dude, I'm getting this. 100% I'm getting this.
We're also looking at this at the lens of like 40 years later, whereas at the time, I don't know, maybe people liked seeing the symmetrical stuff. Maybe people liked some of the different things. You know, it's hard to put yourself in the shoes of a 13-year-old kid in 1980.
I think there's something to say about Patlin games. I think there's something there. You're looking at the list of them, and he's selling the crap out of games. He's a pinball legend.
I think we need to look at the psychology of what this game does, too, because this is a first theme based off a video game.
Mm-hmm.
And during this time, like, they're going up against the, like, first era of mass arcade games. And so the arcade became a battleground for both video games and pinball. And so this is kind of, you know, they're taking a knee a little bit to video games. They're like, no, we'll theme it after a video game, try to pull those kids over there, pump some coins in our machine, and we're going to make, you know, 11,000 of them.
Yep.
It's kind of a trippy thing.
Yeah, and then from there, we go to another Jim Patlin game, his third in a row, mm-hmm. Rolling Stones.
He's a busy man. Yeah, Rolling Stones is fun, easy. Rhodes is like, it's too easy, it's boring, don't do it. And I'm like...
We're talking about classic Rolling Stones here, obviously. You're on the podcast, you're following along, I hope.
Yeah.
We're not talking about the Stern one.
Still in 1980, folks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have too much to say on that. I want to get into the next one.
Yeah.
One of the best pinball machines of all time. It's just an amazing classic from George Christian. It didn't sell very many, so don't let that sway your opinions on it. It's a 1980s Mystic. Yeah, I don't know. Someone take it away.
Brilliantly brutal. Every shot puts you in danger. And just even where your orbits are, it's weird. The trajectory is weird. Like, you have to nail these shots perfectly. And the captive ball to increase your bonus multiplier. Tough shot. Really tough shot.
Yeah.
And like, your front drops to get all those in a row without touching a pop bumper or a side sling to change your value from a pyramid to an eye. And because it's basically a
filling out a tic-tac-toe.
Exactly. Thank you.
Tic-tac-toe, bingo cards. But there are two currencies. There's like the all-seeing eye, or there's like these little pyramids.
Yeah, which alternates with the photorealistic. Like there's a light that changes. Mm-hmm. Whichever one's illuminated on the playfield, it'll change what's displayed on the back glass. It's got a sick art package, too.
The art package is unbelievable. I think it's like, I love the cabinet stencil that they used on it.
Cobras and skulls. Yeah.
Skeleton, but it's got like an Egyptian motif. So it's like skeleton with like one of those Egyptian pharaoh headdresses on. It's just in some snakes.
It's
just
sick,
fucking
man.
Sick.
The back glass, it's kind of, yeah, because it's kind of like a carnival, like fortune teller kind of
all these magicians,
vibe, right?
And then there's Satan like whispering in
someone's
ear.
There's literally Satan on the back glass. It's fucking sick.
It's good.
Go ahead, stick your dick in the mashed potatoes.
Yeah, and it's got three banks of drops, like on the left, the right, and the center. They're all very dangerous, but you need them to complete your boards, like we're saying.
Yeah.
This is like the George Christian. Like, this is one of those games that when you play these, you're just like, fuck yeah, this game is awesome. Every pinball machine could be like that.
Yeah.
And that's why I think we hold them to a high standard when we talk about Dolly and Nitro Ground Shaker and stuff. Because it's like, this is good shit.
Yeah, this is his first.
Which sold so much less, which is strange.
Yeah, that's why we're like, those numbers, they don't mean shit now.
George Christian is an amazing designer, one who we're trying to build a whole episode on for y'all in the future, since he's a lot of our favorite designers from this era.
True, yeah.
Particularly.
Oh, yeah.
Right up there with the Ricci's in my mind.
He doesn't get enough attention now. He sold absolutely, this game didn't sell particularly well, but some of the best-selling games of all time were George Christian's.
Yeah.
It's basically him, Pat Lawler, Steve Ricci. Those are the guys that ever broke 20,000.
Yeah, well, like, look at Jim Patla's games, dude.
Yeah, insane.
Dude, Jim Patla's a monster.
I mean, dude, look what his output in 1980 is insane.
Yeah.
It is insane.
That is insane.
That's a lot of work. He did.
Yeah.
What are we looking at? Four machines? Yeah, four machines in 1980. That's a busy, busy year.
So after Mystic, we get into another one of the Bally wide bodies, Hot Doggin', which is like freestyle skiing themed. It's kind of a unique outlier in this one, because I don't think anyone's too, there's not a lot. I mean, I'm sure people will like it. I haven't spent any time on it, so I don't want to dog on it too hard.
It's the only one on this list I haven't played.
Yeah.
So,
wow. And they did
speak to, I know, I played all of these.
That's wow.
They didn't sell a lot of them. It's an oddball theme. It's funny. It's like the same way I like No Fear. I like the theme and art package and everything.
It's a guy jumping on his skis. It has to be.
I agree with that. I like the name. I like that it's called Hot Doggin'.
Hot dog themed skiing pinball machine. You want to marry two things that are awesome? Hot dogs and skiing.
And then we get into Jim Patla's, I think this is his least successful game, the lowest production number. And it's also probably my favorite on this list, Viking, which is Viking themed. And it's cool as hell. It's so sick. The theme is like, or the art package is awesome. It's got this saucer that it falls into in the middle a lot that will kick it right down the middle and fuck you. It's so good. It's got this shot. It's like what I was saying. It feels like it's symmetrical, but it's not as symmetrical as his other games. It's got a shot that kind of wraps around. So it's got some fun, cool
lots
shit
of spinners,
in it.
Which I think you love, Ron.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And those spinners put that value spinner. And they collect in that saucer. So you get kind of that double hit.
The inlanes are also
unique. It's got really cool. Yeah, they kind of copied that. So keep this topical, Jaws coming out soon from Stern, or already out when you're listening to this. They kind of copied that for that, where there's a post in the out lane and you can bounce it off of that through a one-way gate into the in lane. So it's friendlier than other games of this era in that way, but it also throws it down the middle on you so much, in my experience anyway, that it doesn't really feel overly friendly. It's a cool game.
I think Viking's a kick-ass game.
It is.
Yeah. It's worth a lot because it's rare and it's cool, but it is fun. If you ever see one, make sure you play it. It's very unique.
Yeah, only 2,000 of those made. And it took me up until like this last year that I got an opportunity to play it.
Yeah, not very common. After that, we see Skateball.
Hell yeah.
Skateboarding California van roller skating themed masterpiece.
It's a look into Spicoli's dreams.
Oh, dude, it's so another, man, this is just I'm like getting hyped. The further we go down this list right now, I'm like, you think it's better and better? Skateball is sick.
If you love drops, you love Skateball. If you love unique shots, you love Skateball. If you love shake.
Yeah, it's got that great plunge shot that you can plunge all the way up and around to the top. I think that was Ted Zale, who was a longtime Bally designer before this era. So like 10 years before, he was like in the 60s. He was like the main designer there.
Mm-hmm.
He started doing this.
Oh.
He started with this like cross playfield plunge shot, crosses the whole playfield, and whips back around to the top. So that's sort of like an homage to him.
It's interesting because skateball, if you look at it, it's a good example of like things are more than the sum of their parts. Because if you look at it, it has a very similar layout to Williams Flash, designed by Steve Ritchie. A lot of the stuff's in the same places. You could like say skateball's kind of a ripoff because Flash came out the year before, but skateball plays so much different and so much better.
Yeah, I agree.
It's also got a great switch reverse outlane inlane thing on the left side.
It's got a unique,
even on the right side.
It's got a unique outlane thing on the right side. Yeah, the whole thing is sick.
There's lots of nudging on the outlanes, very unique gameplay.
And it's another one that's kind of friendlier for this era. So if you're new to solid states, I think it's one that kind of sucks you in right away. Because
it really has a big scoring moment.
It does,
like,
yeah.
If you can max out your bonus collect hole, if you can hit it and then survive and then hit it again, you can blow this machine up.
Yep.
It's hard to do, but you can do it. A skilled player can do it. I will say the last thing about this game is this is the first time you see Greg Ferris on art.
Yeah.
Oh. Legendary Greg Ferris, who is still working. He's working at Stern now, right now. I think he's the head of the art department still to this day. But you'll see him through the merger later on when Williams buys Bally, through all the 90s games, kind of famously did a lot of work with, like he did like the Elvira games. He did like the Dr. Dude games, did a lot of work with Dennis Nordman. I mean, did No Fear, the game you have that we talked about.
Oh, yeah. There's the good one.
Greg Ferris is a fucking legend. So,
yes.
Yeah. And this is the first Claude Fernandez game on the list as well.
Yeah. Which is interesting. I don't know much about Claude. I know that he did another game that we're going to talk about shortly, which was my first game. So I'll just hold my peace until then.
So after Skateball, how do you follow up a masterpiece like Skateball?
Better. It only gets better.
With what is 100% my wife's favorite game of all time. It's probably up there for me personally. It's another George Christian masterpiece, zero faults, perfect game, sold like shit. Frontier, 1980, amazing game.
We all love this game.
Perfect game.
Perfect game.
Perfect theme. It's ridiculous and campy and cool as hell at the same time.
This is basically the movie Jeremiah Johnson as a game. It's a guy, there's a guy on the back glass or on the play field in the back glass, like shirt off, holding a knife, fighting a bear.
Yeah. We got some wolves, you know, they're just looming about. You know, if this game kicks your ass, you will spend so much money in quarters in this machine. You don't like quarters, give them to Frontier. They'll take them really fast. But it will, you know, it made me a better player, 100%. Just being able to save the ball from these crazy situations you're put in, where the pop bumpers throw the ball, like your targets, like if you want to hit the targets to advance your animals through the den, instead of going up through the top, like, yeah, good luck. You're going to need to be good at saving the game, you know, the ball.
It's funny because it's one of those games that you play it and the safest shot is ripping the spinner and sending it back up, which feeds into exposed pop. And that's when you realize you're like, no shot's safe. You're fighting for you're fighting for control all the time. And it's just great. It's like a huge like collect bonus cash in kind of game.
Yeah, you're trying to fill your den of predators. There's three columns to your den. You can get them just by the lanes up at top. So you get them off the plunge, or if you hit the spinner, like Alex is saying, you can advance up that way. And there's also three corresponding ABC stand-up targets on the lower play field. But again, every shot's dangerous on the game. You get so close so many times. A bunch of inline drops on the left-hand side.
Yeah, your bear drops.
Your bear drops.
Yeah. Your bonus multiplier,
bear hunting.
God, and that's so much fun.
It's so much fun.
And those bear drops, so George Christian likes doing inline drops like that, but those bear drops are, they're all kind of, I guess, do the same thing, but it's like the shot gets progressively more dangerous the more drops you have down, just because of the way they roll back out of
there. Yeah, it just gains more momentum the further up you go.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it'll hit like the little donut of rubber and just kick out just a little bit more.
You get so cocky because it's like you smash the first drop, you get it right back on the flipper. You're like, oh, yeah, easy. I can just go through that. You're like, if you're not feeling good on the spinner shot on the left flipper, you're like, well, I'm going to just go for bears. And then you get fucked on the third drop, second drop or whatever. And you're like, I'm an idiot. Why did I ever do that? I suck at pinball. and you put another quarter in, and it's just so good.
Yeah, you have to adapt with the game because it is changing on you no matter where the shots are. And yeah, it'll make you better at saving the game, or saving the ball, I should say.
It's one of those games that just feels perfect. It feels...
It really does.
It just feels like everything's in the perfect spot. There's variety in what you shoot for at any given time, especially for a game of this era. People think these games are simple. They are, if you're comparing them to a modern rule set. Damn, they are hard to do.
Yeah.
Hard to do the whole thing.
You got to be skilled. That's the thing.
You
know,
very skilled.
You know, you could have a massive rule set and be a simpleton on the flippers, but you have to be fucking skilled if you want points on this game.
Yes. Yeah. It's so good, and the sound's so good on it.
Sounds so good. Yeah, the crickets start intensifying throughout the gameplay.
And the wolves. I mean, how many times we...
Oh, it's so good.
So good.
Everything about the game is perfect. From there, we get back into a game that actually sold some numbers. Xenon by Greg Kmek. Is that how you pronounce his last name? I never know.
I believe it's Kmek.
I think so.
And yeah, this is a really unique game because it's got full like digital sound. It was composed by a woman whose name I'm blanking on right now.
Susan Ciani.
Yeah, yeah, she's
Suzanne Ciani.
Like 5 Grammys, and was known for like one of the first divas or queens of synth. So like badass composer, badass musician, badass producer.
She's a legend outside of pinball, and just sort of like dovetailed nicely. Yeah, dabbled in pinball, and we benefited from it as pinball fans.
Yeah, because she kind of raised the bar here on like integrated sounds and what you could do with it. And it was also unique because as far as I'm thinking, this was the first game from Bally with a ramp on it.
And multi-ball.
Oh, I didn't know it was the first multi-ball Bally.
Not the first, but it had both.
Oh, gotcha, gotcha.
It had both. Yeah,
and
the first ramp, it's got like a single tube ramp.
Yeah, so if you're a ramp guy, you got one right there. If you're a multi-ball guy, you got it.
It's the first Bally game with speech, right?
Yep. Sorry, that's what I meant.
Yeah, it's the first Bally game with speech, and it's got a ramp. I think the first ramp. It's got like a little tube.
Yep, it has like a 90-degree little metal ramp, and then it goes up into a transparent plastic tube. It's called the tube shot. You know that because Suzanne says over and over, try a tube shot.
Yeah.
It's awesome. The game's very cool. It can be a little one note because you want to throw it up top over and over, but it's a really fun game. It's grown on me a lot.
The art package, so good.
So good.
So good.
It's nice to see that it actually sold 11,000 units because it's an oddball one. You know they put a lot of love and work into it, and it's cool.
Yeah,
it's
very
cool. It's just good all around. After that, you want to talk ramps.
Oh, boy.
We got better than one ramp. We got like 3 up to an upper level.
And our first elevated play field.
Yeah. With Flash Gordon from Claude Fernandez, 10,000 produced, 1981.
So right after a famous game by Steve Ritchie called Black Knight.
Oh, I've never heard of that one.
Never heard of it?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So this is after Black Knight set the world on fire. We're not talking about Williams games here too much.
It's not like Claude copied Steve Ritchie's last big game with Skateball, and now he's maybe copying Steve Ritchie's next big game with Black Knight.
Hey, if you're gonna draw inspiration, draw it from the king, dude.
It's true.
It's got a upper playfield, famously. That's what we're drawing parallels with Black Knight here. Black Knight was the first game with the upper playfield. Flash Gordon has an upper playfield, which you plunge into. There's a flipper up top that you can hit some different drops. It's the first game I owned. It's the first game I bought. I bought a pretty roached out one for about $700. It's the first pinball machine I ever owned. Rhodesy and I went to go pick it up. and he helped me load it in and bring it down to my basement. And the game is famously brutally difficult. Like, unbelievably brutally difficult.
Unrelenting.
Unrelenting. It's got some inline drops on the lower play field on the right hand side.
That's my favorite feature, is just going for those to get extra ball right off the bat because you need it.
Yeah, you need it on that game.
It's another game that every shot puts you in danger. And if you can control it in that situation,
of that game is just getting it up to the upper play field.
True.
It's just like that's what you want to do. That's true. Most upper play field games, but man, it's a good time, and it's based on a famous movie that came out this time.
I have never seen the movie. From the art package, I know Queen did the soundtrack for it.
Yes.
From the art package, it looks fucking batshit. Like,
it's amazing.
Looks insane.
It's great.
It's amazing. It's campy sci-fi space opera.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Before he was Flash Gordon, he was quarterback for the New York Jets.
Oh, wow. That's like in the movie? Or
in the lore. Yeah, that's the character.
Yeah.
Oh,
then he gets on
phenomenal.
A plane and everything goes astray.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay, this seems
pretty
good.
No, it's great. And Emperor Ming, who's the villain in them, it's just fantastic. It's a fantastic movie.
And it's a really good pinball machine. Another one of those. But then, once again, Claude's good work is followed up with another masterpiece from George Christian, and one that could finally fucking sell because it was themed after something everybody loves, pool.
Pool.
This is 8 Ball Deluxe, 1981. They did 13,000 of them or so. And
they reran it a couple times because it was so popular.
Yeah.
And it's a sequel to his previous game, 8 Ball, which...
best-selling pinball machine of all time when it came.
Yes. And at this time was still the best-selling pinball machine of all time. Yep. So this was the sequel to that game. And it's sort of famously one of Ty's favorite games.
Yeah,
so.
This is the first machine I bought. I love this thing so much. All the action around the entire playfield, you don't go for just one strategy. You take what it gives you because it is a motherfucker. You have three naked pop bumpers that can throw the ball absolutely anywhere. And you have to really just catch the ball. And you're like, okay, cool. I'm going to go for the orbit and get extra ball so we can survive longer. Or, you know what? I'm going to be ambitious, knock down all my ball drops, get that 56,000, and then start going for my bonus multiplier. You have to stick to those and just keep it rolling and just hang on for dear life because there's so much chaos within the layout of that game. The ball goes fucking everywhere.
It's so much fun. It's just like one of those ones I just love every time, like trying to go for the 8 ball or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's also got phenomenal call outs.
Yeah.
It's kind of got like the same, it recycles the speech, but it changes.
Yeah, it's a second Squawk and Talk board. The first one was in Flash Gordon. And so, yeah, okay. You get these you get more call outs than you did in previous games.
It had more memory.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
It was still, you know, dinosaur.
Yeah.
But
it tells you what to do, but you're like, no, I don't want to do that. Like,
it's also another very good art package. It's insane. Cohesive all around, and it just like very much has that 80s smoking inside pool hall vibes.
Yeah, it's like, Margaret Hudson's first art pack.
Yeah, which kind of like...
full encompassing art package, I think.
She yeah, because I think she had done some plastics or something, I know.
She has, yeah. But this, I think, might have been her first back glass.
That's kind of sick. So it's like they were working, I don't know, it's kind of cool, Bally, to actually be like working with women artists and like women sound designers and stuff.
Yeah. In the early 80s, time, yeah.
Not something you would have seen prior to this era, for sure. Man, that thing is, 8 Ball Deluxe is genuinely one of the best games of all time.
It's a fantastic game. Everyone loves it. I mean, if you were playing pinball at this era, people will ask you about this game. Like, this is a famous game. And yeah, Margaret Hudson did the full art package here, and she deserves her own episode in the future, which we'll do.
For sure. And she's won awards for this, you know. It, back to what you were saying, Alan, too, like everybody has played this. So like, have like creative directors that I've worked with in the past. So like, oh, you were like pinball? Yeah, yeah, totally. Like, you played 8 Ball Deluxe? I'm like, yeah.
You're like, oh, I've played it, buddy.
You know, oh, I played it. Yeah. Fucking known one. Yeah. And it's, yeah, when you go on location and there's quite a few people out, it's the one like the old timers really gravitate to. And I've seen like an old, like, couple of dudes that will like, they have a little notebook where they keep score of how many times they get free play. Not who has the better score, how many like credits they won through.
That's
specials.
How you know they've been playing pinball for a while.
Yeah. And they only play that. It was kind of charming to see.
Yeah, that's great. After that, we go back to another wide body. It's from Claude Fernandez, Embryon. It's a really cool game. It's got Comic Sans inspired art text. It's got one of the most questionable text or typeface choices on this list.
Yeah, it's...
But it's, other than that, it's kind of like this bizarre sci-fi theme, and it's a cool game. I like that one.
Just a dude holding a giant space egg, you know, harvesting other space eggs.
It's about like
very creepy art by Tony Ramuni.
Yeah.
Very cool, very creepy, weird art.
You build the story around this thing, and it's just bizarre. You're like, oh, you've been in your own space shuttle for a while? He's like, yeah. You want to see my egg collection? You're like, what made those eggs, buddy? Oh, yeah, it's bizarre.
It's good. After that, another game that's known probably mostly for its art is Fathom, Ward Pemberton, in 1981. They made 3,500 of those things, and it's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is Ward's first game. I believe this is Ward's first game.
First on this list, for sure.
I think he came into being a designer around this time at Bally. So I believe this is his first game. It's a very collectible game. An Australian company just remade this, made some new Fathoms, added some new code. It's famous for its art package by Greg Freres, who we talked about earlier. The art package is unbelievable.
It's so like, cool.
The layout's very cool, very interesting.
But Alan, you have like an interesting story about having this at Wedgehead when you first opened.
We had a Fathom I don't know how interesting the story is, but we had a Fathom. And it's one of those games where, being a fan of solid state games, my business partner, Rhodesy, he finally got a nice one. And we had it, and we were so excited, and we were playing it, and we were playing it, and we were playing it. And it was almost like we were kind of looking at each other like, who's going to say it? And then we're just sort of like, there's something about this game, and it's probably just us. It's a well-loved game. It's one of the famous from this era and one of the most expensive from this era.
Yeah.
But we're both kind of like, eh. Like, there's something about it that leaves me flat. I want it to be better
than
it is as a game to play. Because it does have multi-ball.
It does.
It's got a bunch of drop targets, including inline drops.
Yeah, it's kind of like a choose-your-own-adventure game. You like either go blue or green, and that corresponds with the multi-ball you want to get. But other than that, yeah, it does fall flat for me, too. I just kind of lose interest.
I think it's one of those ones, it's just hyped up so much more, and it's worth three times as much as a lot of really good games on this list. And to us, it's like, you try not to let that affect your opinions of games, but it's like, when you know that, and you're like, boy, you could have had three 8-Ball Deluxes or Frontiers for the price of this Fathom, and you're like, it's pretty, but it ain't, like, as good as those other games.
Yeah, a nice piece of furniture.
If it was the same price as everything else, I think we would kind of judge it differently. But all of us, I feel like, went into it with high hopes because it's such a hyped game, and that kind of hurts it. It is gorgeous, though, and I think it's fun. It's got some unique stuff on it. It's got that huge, like, gate at the top that the ball kind of falls through. Mm. It's got some cool stuff, but it's just, it doesn't hit like I wanted it.
No, it doesn't slap as much.
From there, what do we got? Medusa?
Another mid game.
Medusa's another very cool art package, though.
Yeah.
And Medusa's got like the translucent flippers and stuff, right?
Translucent red flippers. It's not a true upper play field. Like, it's not a different level.
It's got like an upper play field
area. Just partitioned.
Yeah. It's partitioned off. But it's got the coolest, like, little between your lower flippers. Like, as your center train on a gimmick episode, we talked about extra button gimmicks.
Yeah, this is a good one.
And it's a good one because it's got like a little post that kind of like, if you drain down the center, you can press the extra button on the side of the cabinet. It'll kind of punch it. Like, it'll punch it back up into the center of the play field.
It's so sick.
And
it's
you
like, yeah.
Only
it's
get five fun. Of those punches. And Jason had this for a while, and we got kind of bored of playing it. You're like, okay, you can't hit the ball with the flippers. You can only punch it with the center. See who gets the highest score. That entertained us a little bit more than playing it regularly.
From there, we have another gorgeous game that does not land for me again. It's Centaur, 1981 still. And how many did they sell of this?
Not enough. I love it. I'm on the opposite side of the spectrum. I have a lot of fun playing it. There's
I know
some bizarre
you
moments,
love it.
For sure.
This is another one Haggis is remaking because there's a huge demand. They're valuable. And
it's because they didn't make a lot, again, like Fathom. They only made 3,700. This is a Jim Patla game. It's probably, if you asked a lot of people to look at this list, they would say this is his best game that he ever designed, which is strange that they made so few of them. But I think, like Ty was saying, Pac-Man was released in November of 1980.
Yeah.
So video games were directly competing with pinball.
Yeah.
So the games that he was selling in 79 and 1980, now when he's Centaur in 1981, Pac-Man's already broke. You have a lot of other games like Space Invaders, and you have these big games, Robotron. You have all these games that are eating up quarters. So you're starting to sell less pinball.
Yep.
You know, the market's saturated. Everyone wants to play video games.
You need a gimmick, too. And this game provides it in an interesting way. You can have up to 8 balls in play for multi-ball.
Yeah, which is wild.
It's insane.
It's like this. We're in the era where like multi-balls at all are still like a novelty. And then it's like it has an auto launcher, right? Is this?
Yeah, it's up to the upper right-hand portion of the game.
Yep.
It's got great, again, in lanes where you could bounce the ball from an out lane off of a post back into the in lane through a gate.
Got to spell orbs in order to get your first multi-ball. And then, you're off.
And the art package is black and white. Chromatic.
Yeah, the philosophy was they wanted the lights to do the coloring, and they have like lots of colored inserts, and so that was provided.
Yeah, so like red and green.
And some blues. So your orbs are blue, lots of red. But yeah,
another gorgeous art package.
It's got a half motorcycle, half man guy on the back glass. Really sick.
Yep.
Yeah. Bug lady riding his back.
Yeah, it's just like everyone's dream to be half motorcycle, half human.
It's so metal. The art package is just so metal.
You know the art package was lifted? I don't know if you guys have ever seen the album cover for Lady Gaga's Born This Way. And it's straight up like she's half motorcycle and it's black and white.
Oh, no shit.
100%. There's no confirmation, because how would you confirm something like that? But you see it. Like, if you guys saw it out of context, you'd be like, well, that's knockoff, like, Centaur.
I'll call her and ask her.
It's 100% stolen Centaur.
Yeah, Lady Gaga's an easy get. We should just ring her.
Yeah, don't worry. I'll have her on the podcast.
Yeah, we'll get her on the podcast. We'll talk about it in the Lady Gaga episode.
We took her on speed dial a while ago, but she always picks up.
Yeah.
And then after this, we get to our last game of this before the U.S. government rudely canceled the Susan B. Anthony coins on us, mm-hmm. and it's Electra. Yeah, how many of that one were made?
2,950 of them.
And that's from Claude Fernandez again. And do you guys have much to say about Electra?
I just mesmerized by like the back glass. That's about it. I play it and I'll get a little lost. There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just, like, only opportunity I have to play this is at Next Level, and it's next to a bunch of other amazing games, so I just kind of fade it.
That's been my experience too. I've played it to play it, and it hasn't stuck with me. It's a game that I probably should put some more time on, because looking at this list, I like Claude Fernandez's other games a lot.
Yeah.
And so,
off for Electra?
Yeah, we got to find what Williams looks exactly like this playfield. But yeah, that's kind of it. It's a really unique era for Bally, because it's like we said, these games are gorgeous. Mm-hmm. They're some of the best games ever made. They're some of the biggest selling games ever made. They're really iconic. If you ask a lot of older guys that have been in the hobby for a long time, their best games, chances are this SBA era would capture at least one of them.
It does, yeah. And yeah, production really drops off in 1982. They go from producing like 10 games to 8 games, and then in 1982 drops to 5 unique properties.
Well, yeah, man, they stop producing the Susan B. Anthony coin and everything goes to shit.
arcade profits plummeted once they quit.
The economy took a dump.
You know, this has me really curious, and I know we've got some Canadian operator friends that you've talked to in the past, Alan, but if we ever get a chance, we should ask them about loonies and toonies and how they handle them up there.
Yeah, I will. We're trying to get a couple Canadian operators on the show here shortly in the future.
Dude, I would love to install like a loony or toony coin acceptor in a rush or something in the States.
Yeah, that'd be,
and like
that'd
make
be
it be like
cool.
You drop a toony in and you get 10 games or something.
Metric,
just be like absurd, because
sure.
It would just be funny to see if anyone brought a toony in.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, put them here, bud.
Oh, it's for the nice price, eh? So one toonie will get you 10, and it's the metric system, so it's 10. So it's extra nice for you. A loonie, on the other hand, only 5. But still nice. You just use one of those, eh?
So, yeah, I think that kind of wraps it up. Do you guys got anything you wanted to say before we, close out this golden era of Bally's?
This truly is the golden era of Bally's. This is their rocket shot from kind of last place in the pinball industry and the pinball minds to first place. It's a very short period that we covered. What, 2 years?
Yeah, 2 years.
And they made that many games. They made 23 games.
It's insane, man.
Yeah, and just a weird confluence of events where you do have the uprise of video games and arcades, and then they really have to come to bat with these heavy-hitting, solid-state beauties. And they did. They delivered on every expectation of making sick games.
Jim Patla, Greg Kamek, George Christian, you know, Ward Pemberton, Bob Fernandez, like these guys showed up.
Yeah, they're fighting for their lives. And you see that throughout pinball again and again. Every time the industry's in peril, people put some of their best work forward. And I think we'll talk about that sometime when we get into like System 11 eras, because I know that was another crash. And it's just cool.
This will be a familiar refrain of the pinball rise and fall in popularity over its different eras. But this is the golden era. This is the Susan B. Anthony years of Bally Pinball from 1979 to 1981. And I'm your host, Alan, from the Wedgehead Pinball Podcast. I want to thank my guest, Ty Palmer.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Great friends. You can see him at Wedgehead behind the bar, and he'll kick your ass on Skateball or Harlem or any one of these fucking games if you get the wrong idea.
Let's play some dollar games.
Ty will kick your ass on any of these solid state games. He's an assassin. Thanks, Alex, once again for hosting us in your basement studio. For everyone listening, I'm going to end this like I always end these episodes. I'm going to implore you, try to find some of these Bally games. You've heard the stories. Try to go find some of these games. Use the pinball map. Support operators that put some of these really cool old games out there. A lot of these games are just in collections now. They're in private collections. Dude's got them cheap, and they're just stored away in some basement. Go out and play them on location. They're incredible games. Some of the best games Bally ever made in their entire history are right here in these 2 years. and I hope you go out and enjoy them. Until next time, good luck. Don't suck.